Yeah, try to keep reasonably close to that. So
okay.
As a relief to start, have you ever seen a magazine called Gardens and Guns?
No. I would like to.
I was in the, yeah. Well, it is a umpteen-ump publication. It, you know, it's a high class.
I don't know.
I mean, flashy. I'll show you. But I had to stop by the dentist office yesterday, and this guy said, he's seen your name. And I said, what are you talking about? He brings out this magazine, the lead article by Reynolds Price, and there's a whole section in there on food and, you know, the restaurants and the market and so on and so forth, and lists a bunch of others that sell there. I can't imagine they're going to make it on subscriptions, but who knows. Oops.
And what are the guns?
Well, that's part of their, they're in the guns too. Hello. Yes. Yes, sir. What are you doing? I am. I'm sorry about that. Well, I tell you, the tracks, they're not running the trains except the weekend because they're working on the tracks. I'll call you. Thanks. Bye. At any rate, I'll show it to you. Gardens and Guns. And Reynolds Price, that was, those three is somehow or other.
I guess that
was my thought. You know, somebody's paying some bucks. And it's, we're not talking about tissue paper here. We're talking about serious paper and print and.
Like these, fine.
Oh, it's
fine house building.
Yeah.
Architectural digest.
Right. It's probably cut above that. Anyhow, never heard of it before, but Morton Neal wrote the article, and I think did a pretty good job. I'll give it again. He wrote an article in it, but the article about the farmers markets and the restaurants and stuff about Morton Neal. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
She's Bill Neal's wife, was a part owner in La Residence. I don't know if she still is or not. Really active in things around Chapel Hill. She's a good lady.
Okay, so our goal here is to get something down on tape that can be converted over to the print word.
Right.
And the idea is if we do it seasonally and have these topics laid out, then if you feel the urge to talk about something over here, I may try to hold you off and say,
right,
well, we'll talk about it the next time so that we can
cover. Right.
But if you feel a burning urge to not take direction, you know, more power to you. So it's, you know, if you just feel compelled to talk about deer in the winter rather than in the summer. But
yeah, well,
move things around.
Okay.
All right. But this is just a loose way to keep it from going all over the place.
Okay.
So the first question is trying to get at winter. And one thing I'll say is that the mic probably can't pick me up very well. And I'm going to try to say as little as possible.
Okay.
But if there's some way you could kind of repeat the question in the way you start out, that would be a help for the getting it down on the process. So the first question.
In terms of starting, just for the record here, this is the 29th of February. you know, the first day of March is upon us, and we usually start planting on the first day of March. So everybody's sort of in gear and ready, but given the temperature has been the last few nights, which has been down in the mid-20s, it's probably going to be the first next week. But and it's a leap year. But this is always sort of anxious times because you want to get the stuff in the ground, but you don't want to get in there so soon that you lose it. And so we'll see. It's frustrating in some respects. In a guessing game. Most of us guessing anyway.
So getting to the first question, what is happening on the farm in February and winter? What is winter on the farm about?
What's winter and particular February on the farm all about? Well, winter, as far as the season is concerned, for us is usually starting first or second week in January. At that point, we've finished, you know, with the crops on the farm and probably made our last deliveries and got stuff squared away as far as the former season is concerned. And the next 2 months, January and February, are a matter of fixing equipment, making plans about what you want to grow and how much and where, and ordering seed and plants, and making arrangements for transplants to be grown, get in supplies, compost, feather meal, just the stuff you're going to need and you ain't got time to go get when the time comes. The other thing about machinery is that you don't machinery doesn't break unless you need it, and you don't need it unless you're planting or doing something. So it can be very aggravating, and you hope that everything's fixed and ready to go, but you never know. And consequently, for us anyway, we've got two of everything as far as machines are concerned, and it's the only insurance you can have against being shut down because you've lost a machine of some kind. And that really brings up another whole area that we work on in that time, is to get all the hand tools in shape, handles fixed, blades sharpened, get, you know, the shovels and all that stuff scraped off and oiled. And so just, you know, maintenance stuff and supplies are the big things.
This a part of the farming life that you particularly like or don't like, or where does it stack up?
For the most part, I like it because 3, maybe 4 weeks are spent traveling. You know, either to Mississippi to see my brother and folks down there, or if I've got, you know, if the finances will allow for it, maybe get overseas. And I've got a couple of projects I'm working on in England and Scotland, and historically, and a chance to work on those on site rather than trying to do it at a distance. Given the exchange rate these days, that's not such a good policy. In fact, it's terrible. But on the other hand, went on a shorter trip this year. It was 2.5 weeks instead of 4. And
so it's a time to get away.
Just get out. You know, you're tired of it, and you just need to get away. It's also, you know, the anxiety of, are we ready? Have we got stuff ready? You know, when do you put it in the ground? Well, it's a little too cold this week. Let's wait just a little longer. And all that, plus tax time's coming, and so you gotta get the taxes done, which is a long process because of all the farm stuff. Just separating out the bills, and you know, are these supplies, and is this equipment, and this repair, and I mean, just on. But on the other hand, the upside of that is it's when you really find out whether or not you made any money. because I mean you may have some money in the bank, but it may not really be there because you just got finished drilling a well, which we did. I haven't paid for it yet. Don't know if I got the money to pay for it. So it is sort of a rest time in some respects, but it's also a lot of anxiety about getting started. And, you know, have we got enough people to work, and are they going to show up, and you know, all that sort of business.
So taking it at its most idyllic, or perhaps most literary, say something about the notion of resting in the land, resting.
Well, you hope that both of you are doing it. You know, rest can be laying down and sleeping, or it can be just changing what you're doing. And that's sort of the way it is for me, anyway. So the doing changes, but there is some rest in it. And the rest of the question was, I'm sorry.
Well, the land.
Yeah. The land obviously is undergoing a couple things. One is we've in the fall everything has been turned in and planted with a cover crop. In our case, most of it is in crimson and clover or rape, which is a green that has not got the nitrogen content that the clover does, but on the other hand, it goes through the winter and you can pick it and eat it, or you can pick it and sell it if there's enough of it for winter, if the cold weather hasn't done it in. You may have noticed some of it down there when you walked up. So I think we could say that the ground is at rest. That's not really the case because there's a lot going on in there, and clover comes up, but so does the henbit and the chickweed, and we started tilling beds 3 weeks ago, I guess, just to try and kill off the henbit and stuff that haven't ready to plant. So it's at rest in some respects, but it's not really. But it is certainly calmer than it is during the spring, summer, and fall. Yeah.
How do you feel about being outdoors in the winter? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? In North Carolina.
In North Carolina, yeah. Well, it's not at its prettiest time, unless you got a big snow out there, which we haven't had this year. It's cold. The dogs and I walk a couple miles every morning. Some days are prettier than others, you know, according to what the sun's doing.
The days are short,
which means that you can get a lot more reading done that you have piled away, and is tilting on the edge of flooding the room. But yeah, it initially is restful, but by the time you get to this point in it, I mean you're geared up and ready, then there's a certain amount of anxiety that, I mean, you know, if you've done it umpteen times, it ought to be okay, you ought to have it right, but you just never know. You know, something can always happen.
Early winter and late winter are different.
Yeah. You know, and it's things like, we've been trying to get this well drilled since last fall. And you know, people said, well, we'll come get that done, you know, and it got put off. And that was part of my doing, up to the point of, you know, the end of January. And then we got to get this done because we need the water. And we got to plant. And we need the water to plant with. So, you know, they finally get out here to drill the well, and the guys from CPNL over here, and I'm sure there's a big red star on my name in the files over there because they all seem to know me for whatever reason. they come over and they say, well, yeah, but we got to have a transformer up on the pole, and it's going to be X number of dollars that you pay for it. And Mobine, by the way, we can't get one in here for 6 weeks. Well, I can't believe in my wildest imagination that CP&L, which is within 2 miles of this place, with a maintenance yard full of transformers, poles, and everything else, hasn't got a transformer over there that we can stick on one of these poles. It's just, it's just, if there isn't one over there, it's incompetence, and if there is, and they're lying to me, then that's, But it's either that or go over and steal it, so you're all in their time, And then you call the electrician, because they got to come out and do this, that, and the other thing, and that, well, we'll be there at 9 o'clock, and, you never see them, and they don't call, and the guy, there's somebody else who's got to come in and bury the line, well, but they can't do it until the transformer's up there. It's a shell game, and you're the one who's up against the wall of we got to get going, and they don't seem to feel the same pressure. I don't know why. and it's not directed at me personally. I think that's where we are in these days of what's going on in Chatham County. There's plenty of work for them to do, or there has been, and I don't know how you tell somebody you're going to be there, and then you don't do it, and you don't call, and so on and so forth, in spite of our fiasco this morning. but they didn't seem to bother them, So anyhow, we will start without a well. Hopefully the trick to it, and which we've all done before, is to plant right before you think it's going to rain. Gambling, but. You ain't got much choice.
So you have the well dug, but there's no pump.
No pump in it, no electricity to it. So, it's, but then I haven't paid them yet either, so. And they haven't sent me a bill yet either. Anyhow, so winter, the early part of winter is less anxiety provoking. You're sort of winding down from picking and delivering and all that kind of stuff and thinking about getting out of here. And at this point of the winter, the anxiety is back up. Have you got enough time to get the taxes done? Is everybody going to show up? Is it going to rain? I think we've got all the seed, but, I may have forgotten something. And, we got the leeks ready to stick in the ground, but it's a doggone cold at night. But, so at any rate,
so this is a good segue to tell me why you wanted to become a farmer. what was the genesis of that, and why organic farmer?
Well,
as colorful as possible.
I if I could get up, I would go get that magazine and read you a quote in there. Which is right around the corner. Let me do that. All right. Can we do that? I'll clip this in real quick. Okay, well, this is out of a periodical called Garden and Gun, 21st Century Southern America. It was a lead article by Reynolds Price, and it's a pretty spiffy thing. I've never seen it before, and I haven't found anybody else that's ever seen it before. But and a friend, Morton Neal, is the one that wrote the article, and as starts with a very nice picture of Andrew Rising on the front. But Morton, to answer your question about how it is that I got into this, this is what the general idea is around, I guess, that at the heart of Slow Foods Triangle chapter are the dozens of farmers markets, including the Carborough Farmers Market, one of the most successful in the United States. Started 30 years ago by a doctor-turned-farmer who thought that providing good food was the best way to affect people's health. Well, that's they're talking about me, yeah, and that's not quite, you know, I mean, good food is important to health. It is not the best way. I mean, the best way is, when all said and done, is to improve people's income. That's the bottom line. But it is that I think that ideas have their own particular time, and the example I like to use has to do with breastfeeding. When I was a student and an intern and a resident, we had all the data that we've got now about the good things about breastfeeding. But I could have stood on my head and spit wooden nickels. I ain't going to do it. You know, I mean, just flat out, folks weren't going to do it. I don't want to. Grandma says it's bad. You know, there's a thousand reasons, but it wasn't going to happen. Well, now we jump, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, and everybody's breastfeeding, more or less. Well, we don't have any more data now than we had before, but it became the thing to do. You know, there's certain things that society sort of takes on, not for necessarily good or bad reasons, it's the time. And breastfeeding is that time. And that does more than, as I say, I mean, everybody could have stood on their head and spit wooden nickels, and it wasn't going to happen. So I think that the time has also come about food, and that's been, I think, clear for 20 or 30 years. And the results had to become fairly obvious to people that something was wrong, such as obesity and hypertension and, you know, on and on and on. They had to be in a situation where they're eating two out of three meals every day out of the home, and then somebody points out to the fact that maybe what they're eating on those two out of three meals a day isn't so good for them. And then, well, what's the alternative? Well, the alternative back to where we were before, that, you know, there are folks that grow stuff locally. They can be done. There can be a relationship between farmers and consumers, and it's good for your health. And health sort of is on the tail end of that in some respects, because most people want to look at the economics and what have you, but health is a major issue. It's a major issue in terms of the quality of the food that's being taken in, probably as important, if not more so. It has to do with how it's grown. And there's simply, from the standpoint of the chemicals used, not sufficient data to verify their use and not be harmful to people.
So take us back to when you first have this idea. That, I mean, you made a major shift professionally.
Well, yeah, but see, I've been working when I was in medical school. Well, how far back do you want to go? I was in medical school and probably burr in the saddle of some of the folks in the administration and faculty because there really wasn't much talk about people and their situations and the social side of things. It was very academic. And the medical school I was going to, Vanderbilt, saw themselves as turning out teachers of medicine, not necessarily practitioners. And even if you're going to be a teacher, you still need to know, from my viewpoint, you still need to know what the situation is out there. It's not just a matter of blood count and your level of cholesterol. It has to do with the relationship between people and whether or not we've got insured people that can afford to get health care and on and on and on. There are a lot of social aspects to it. So, in 1968, the dean, John Chapman, came around to see me, and he said, there's going to be a foundation in New York called the Josiah Macy Foundation that's going to put on a meeting to look at are the radical medical students in America going to take over the medical schools? Would you be interested in going? Well, I've never been to New York, and they're going to give me a ticket to go. And I thought, you know, I don't know anything about radical medical students, but, you know, I can go to New York. Let's go. Well, there were 15 of us, and each one of us was from a different medical school around the country. And that really was what they wanted to hear about. Were the radical medical students going to take over? Well, I mean, it was a ludicrous question, because if you were a radical student, you wouldn't have gotten in. And if you'd become one when you're in there, they'd kick you out. So it showed a certain large degree of naivete, but nonetheless. And to make a long story somewhat shorter, basically what they said was, we're concerned about the group in this room causing trouble, and for a payoff of $20,000-$30,000 to keep you off the streets, you know, we think we can, you know, see if we can expedite that matter. And I don't mind being bribed, and I can. And so before I left New York, I sort of hashed up this idea about, we need to know more about what's going on in the rural areas, and in this case in Tennessee, and both in East Tennessee and other places, and we really to decide where we want to go with a project. You know, we got to go out and get some homework. And that the underserved population in East Tennessee is primarily white back in the mountains. The underserved population in West Tennessee is primarily agricultural black. We have two black medical schools in the country in Nashville, Meharry. So let's see if we can work out some joint activities here that sort of survey and see where we are and what might be done. And I said, fine. Okay. So, went back, and then I got to make this happen rather than just sort of talking about it. And so we did, and by we, I had a good fortune of finding Dr. Amos Christie, who'd been head of the pediatrics department for years and years and years, and had just retired, had time on his hands, didn't mind being a burr and folk saddle, and a good guy. In fact, he was the one, or at least by his rendition of it, he was the one that integrated the hospital there at Vanderbilt. It used to be that the ward for infants, for the black infants, was in the basement. And he came into work one morning and went down and picked one up and walked upstairs and put it in the crib, and that was it. And I'm sure there was more to it than that, but basically that's what happened. And so he was willing to stick his neck out, and then I can remember him always saying, well, boys, I don't, you know, what you do is your business, but I just need to know what it is so that when I go to the bank, I know what to say. And that was he wasn't going to the bank, but there were people asking questions. So we were very fortunate to have him. And I was fortunate to find several other medical students. And then we got to talking with Dr. Christie about this whole business about nurse practitioners. And at that point, there wasn't such a thing. Well, that's not quite true. Jim Silver had started a pediatric nurse practitioner program in Colorado. And Dr. Christie, who knew Jim Silver, was very impressed with it. And he said, you know, maybe we ought to get some nurses involved. So what we did was, for the first month and a half of the project, we made a deal to go down and examine, and this is a long story, so, okay, to examine Head Start children in Williamson County. Now, Williamson County was the next one south from Nashville, rural county, but exposed to all the stuff going on in Nashville. The health director there had been a man who'd been ahead of the state public health department for years and years and years, and his son actually was the director, and he was sort of in the background, but very much involved in what was going on for the son. So what happened was the medical students, we were first or second year students, and the nursing, what we did, we found two recent nursing graduates. And Dr. Christie taught everybody how to do histories and physicals. No difference. Medical student, nursing, whatever. And we went out and examined Head Start kids in Williamson County. And a couple things became apparent. One was that almost all of them, let me back up. As I recall, and I can't give you the exact figure, but at least half the kids had parasites. And the old adage was, as far as Vanderbilt was concerned, was that, well, you know, that's time, that's the past. They don't have parasites anymore. The Rockstar Foundation took care of that. Well, surprise, surprise. Yeah, that didn't do it. It probably wasn't as bad as it had been, but it certainly wasn't over with. The other thing was that by looking in the mouth, you could tell whether or not the kid was from out in the country or in town. If they were from in town, they'd been drinking fluoridated water. They didn't have near the dental caries as the kids from out in the country had. And it was just glaring. I mean, it wasn't just a couple cavities here and there. It was terrible. And of course, dental caries have ramifications. There's just that latent infection going on in there that really sets you up for a lot of other stuff. And it's a real problem. So, what's going to happen about all that? Well, the worms wasn't that big a deal because the health department was willing to recognize those, and we had well-documented results and so on and so forth. So that somewhat got taken care of. The dental caries was interesting. Obviously, there isn't going to be a water system out in the rural areas that can provide fluoridated water. But you can do a topical application of fluoride. It's just like a toothpaste, and you put it on, do it a couple times a year, and it cut dental caries by a third. So, we went to the dental supply place, got a couple tubes of fluoridated toothpaste, got some toothbrushes from a toothbrush company, and proceeded to visit the kids, you know, in home, and would do it with the whole gang, you know, not just the one that we'd seen, but, you know, if there were other kids around, we got everybody into it, show them how to brush your teeth and put on this top application fluoride. Well, we get a call, the fellow that was with me, we get a call one day that the sheriff is on the way to get us, and we better get out of Williamson County. And I thought, what do you mean the sheriff? Well, you're practicing medicine, practicing dentistry. What are you talking about? But nonetheless, we boogied and got across the county line, and here was the deal when we got to looking into it. The guy who had been the head of the state public health department for years and years and years had studied this particular situation personally and knew what the results were and knew that the topical application of fluoride decreased by a third. But it had never been done. It had been put on the shelf. And he was the guy, and his son were the ones that called the sheriff to come and get us for practicing dentistry and medicine. Now, you know, I'm a little slow about things, but you know, at that point, you'd be saying, wait a minute, you know, what the hell is going on here? And if I hadn't sort of been somewhat irritated with the system up to that point, that did it. You know, that really was blatant, inexcusable, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I think we sort of lit the fire under myself, if it needed to be, and some others. So
you recognize that the medical profession was a guild with rules.
Oh, yeah.
That you were going to be in it, you're going to have to follow the rules.
Well, I don't know how much you recognize it up to that point. I certainly did after that. That doesn't mean that you necessarily, I mean, rules, well, that's off on another tangent. But nonetheless, there's also the kid. And if you want to set me up between rules and kid, the kid gets it every time. You know, you may have to change the rules, or you may have to sort of do some bargaining or so on and so forth, but you don't bargain with a kid. Shouldn't. It does, and it happens all the time. I mean, look at the present healthcare situation. But at any rate, so
you graduated and started practicing.
No. That summer, we so that finished us off as far as Head Start Kids and we in county were concerned. And there are a couple of articles in the papers, I recall, and so on and so forth. And in the end, I think the health department finally got itself off its do-nothing stool, but it took a while. And there were some frayed feelings and so on and so forth. The last part of that summer was spent by myself and one of the other students in East Tennessee, working alongside a woman who was a nurse that was put on what were being called health fairs, sponsored primarily by the Presbyterian Church. And basically, she had a station wagon with some posters and a card table and a few other things in the back of the station wagon, was traveling around to old coal camps and places in Tennessee and up in Kentucky, putting on a health fair, you know, sort of a... And there were some exciting times about all that. I remember being in Harlan County one night, and we were supposed to meet there the next day in a little place called Everett's. And we got into town, and it was close to midnight. It was in Harlan. And the only light on was at the sheriff's office. So we pulled up. We were supposed to be at a house up in Everett's. Didn't know how to get there. And the guy with me, Pat Maxwell, a nice guy and a good guy, but not real experienced in the ways of the world. And when we walked in, this deputy was sitting on the far side of the room behind a desk with his feet up on a desk and his revolver in his hand, and he's cleaning the revolver. And I guess Pat had, you know, he liked guns or whatever. He walked over, and we sort of introduced ourselves and spoke, so on and so forth. And Pat walked over and just took the thing right out of the guy's hand. Nice gun, you know, so on and so forth. And here, the deputy sheriff's mouth dropped open, my mouth dropped open. Get out of here. And we managed to talk our way out of that and get out, and he directed us up to this place we're supposed to be staying, up in Everett's. And driving up there, you're on a mountain road, and there's a downside and the upside. Well, the house that we were staying in was on the upside. But we did notice a little house on the downside because we were looking for houses. Got into the right place, and they took us in and put us in bed and so on and so forth. Next morning, got up and walked down the front porch, and the little house down below was gone. I thought, I would have sworn, you know, and sort of looked around, and it's smoldering. I mean, it was there, but it's not there anymore. And I said, what happened? And they said, well, you know, so-and-so, he had a fire last night, and the place burned down. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. What do you mean? Well, it turned out that he was bootlegging, and apparently he passed off some bad stuff, or who knows what happened. But I thought, whoa, this is a different way of handling things. It burned. Let's just put it that way. And that's all I knew. And that's all they said. They may have said somebody burned it, but it burned. Now, growing up, you know, we had a farm in Kemper County, Mississippi, which is way outside of, you know, Meridian, which is the second largest town in the state at 50,000. And bootlegging was a major issue there too. So I wasn't all that ignorant about that particular phase of things, but I had, and fire was a way of sort of, you know, your pastor got burned, and then the next time, if you didn't learn your lesson, something else got burned, and it, you know, the fire was
a weapon.
But just, you know, right over the side of the front porch. It was on the downside of the road, but, you know, and then everybody was sort of blasé about it. Okay? At any rate, what she was doing was you know, drawing some crowds and so on and so forth. Well, I shouldn't say crowds. Drawing some folks. But our estimation of it was that it needed two things. One, the medical part of it really needed to be booted up, you know, to do a lot more than simply just sort of talking to kids about a few things, and I mean, which is really all, I mean, that was all that she could do. And that there needed to be local sponsorship. And she had done some of that, but not nearly on the scale of what it took to really, you know, make this thing rock and roll, if you're gonna. And it was going to have to be, if it was going to make a difference in the medical system, it was going to have to be more than just a couple of kids along the road, you know, so on and so forth. The woman's name was Linda Oker, and I haven't seen her in years, but she's a good lady, and I have the utmost respect for what she did. It certainly helped us. The other person that helped us up there was a woman named Maurice Cirillo, who was doing a lot of community work back down in Tennessee, and introduced us to Linda and some other folks. So
all these experiences were building your frustration with.
If we're going to dive back in the food system, that's going to take a little time to get there. But let me just say, it was clear that you know it could be a good project if we really sort of revved it up. And the result of that became what was called the Student Health Coalition, which did in fact put on health fairs with a lot of local sponsorship of those that were willing to do it. Now you got to remember this is in the 60s and 70s, and things were a little different in those days. There was also a lot of dealings as far as the coal and trucks and so on and so forth. It was not without its exciting moments. To come back to the Meharry side of things, what the agreement had been was that they were going to take a look at what was going on in Nashville and sort of think about what they want to do, and then we were going to come together at the end of the summer and take a look at, you know, what needed to be done overall. And that's what happened. Hello. Yes. I did a while back, but we got it all squared away. I was looking for tea, and we got it, and Fred's had it, and so we're squared away. He'd been down to the other house, and he'd hidden his car behind the red van down there, and so when I walked down there, I could see the front of the house, and when anybody around, I thought, what's going on? Well, he was there somewhere. I know it. And so, yep. He's still here. He's warming up. He was a little cold, I think, but he's warming up. We did, yeah. All right. Okay. All right. Bye. You did get the hello, I assume. Yeah. And so that whole business has gone on, and there are many, and that's been 30 years, and it's still changed. Obviously, if it's a student organization, it's going to change, and there were out another one started in Alabama and Georgia and over here in Carolina and in Texas. So it was a good project. Now, one of the things that to get into the food thing that you asked about.
We'll do that.
Yeah. It became clear in whether it was out in West Tennessee or up in the mountains that the issue of health care had to do with money. There were some facilities around, but it took money. And the health fair itself, you know, could find that Uncle Fred had high blood pressure, but if Uncle Fred didn't have the money to go get something for it, we're not going anywhere. So what happened with that was that we hired a couple of students to specifically look at social programs, Medicaid, Medicare, and so on and so forth, and help folks begin to see where there were programs available. And a number of those communities set up their own health services, built their own clinics, hired staff, and so on and so forth. And the person who really ramrodded putting together that social agencies network thing was Lark Hayes, who's now head of the Southern Environmental Law Center up here. So we were fortunate to have some pretty good folks working with us. We were all students in those days, long ago. Now, to get to the agriculture thing, so there was no question that money was the issue. And if you looked in rural areas, be they in West Tennessee, East Tennessee, or wherever, the one thing that the folks in rural areas had going for them was they knew how to farm. Now, they may have not been doing it for the last generation, or didn't think that it could be successful, but they still had the land, some of them, and they still had some of the equipment, and some of them knew how to do it. And so the question was, where is the breakdown in this system? Why is it that these folks don't want to grow anything and then not make any money? Well, because they're growing crops that unless you had a lot, you couldn't make any money off of. And that had been what I'd seen at home. We're grazing cows and soybeans on 150 acres. You can't compete with somebody with 5,000 acres because they can undercut the price. Because the big guys can undercut the price and leave you out. So if you've got to sell at the big man's price, you're not going to make it. Now, there's a lot of people in between you and the person doing the eating who's got their hands in the till. What you can do, is there a way of cutting out some of those hands between the person doing the growing and the person doing the eating? And again, leaving out a long story, but the health projects had set up what was called the Center for Health Services there on the campus of Vanderbilt. And within that structure, we had a couple of sort of exploratory courses. John Gavina, who was very much involved in the Nader stuff at that time and was a Rhodes Scholar, took a year off to come back and work on some material about the tax structure in these counties. I had another group that looked at the agriculture stuff, and there were several other groups going. The business about agriculture was that if you cut out the people in between, it seemed like they ought to be able to make money, at least on paper. And that's always been the argument with my dad, you know. And if the folks in rural areas can start making some money, then health care is possible. And hopefully their diet's better. It's hard to beat ho-hos and Twinkies, but, you know, you can, we think. So it was about that time that the National Farmers Organization, or the NFO, came along, and they were pushing for organization, especially in the dairy industry. And one of the things they did was to sell ground meat off of trucks, which set up a parking lot somewhere. So it was easy. easy, and they were going big, and we thought, now there's an idea. Meat isn't all that folks got, but it will work. The old farmer's market will work, but when we looked at where the existing farmer's markets were, they're all downtown. The one in Nashville was downtown. People didn't go down there anymore. The people had moved out in the subdivisions and suburbs. Kroger's, Food Lion, everybody, they'd all moved out there with them. The farmers were still downtown. Well, obviously they're not going to make any money down there because there's nobody down there. And they're having to sell at wholesale now instead of retail. But our thought was, you know, if we can get them out there, put them down there next to Kroger's or wherever, we can whip Kroger's and still, you know, make money. Because Kroger's got their price way up. And you're just asking the farmer to take his up only part way. He can undercut Kroger's. You know, the economics aren't hard to see. And to make a long...
You were coming to the... You were exploring all this and coming to these conclusions right after you got out of medical?
Well, I was at this point a house officer. And the project went on with, you know, there was student leadership for the project every year, and the Student Health Coalition, and it went on. And then we started, I was a director of the Center for Health Services, and we started this agriculture marketing project. That was one of the projects that got started in there. There were several others that were of great merit, but we'll leave those alone. You were asking about agriculture, though. I mean, the internship was a year, and residency was 2 years, and then I did consulting work for some of the clinics. I was seeing kids for the clinics. Mostly the communities hire nurse practitioners. That's another whole long story. That you know the project continued to hire nursing students, and the nursing students and medical students were. No difference. And a lot of those women who went through that as nursing students became nurse practitioners and midwives and so on and so forth, and they're all over the country at this point. And the medical students got a lesson in the fact that nurse practitioners could do all right. The nursing school wasn't terribly enamored with it, however. They fought it tooth and nail, but that's another story, too. Anyway, so get back to the food stuff. This argument had begun with my dad over what had been going on at home. About, you know, people would call him, Mr. Dad, we'd like to buy some meat from you. Well, no, you don't do that. You take it to the stockyards, you sell it there. He just flat out would not do it. And you could sit down with pen and paper and say, look, you know, nope. Well, okay.
He wanted to sell also.
That's what he knew. That's the way he thought it ought to be. And he had excuses for it, but, you know, and being the oldest son, he and I had had our differences along the way, and given the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of differences. So, you know, part of it for me was that this is going to work, and, you know, we're gonna find some ways to get some money back in the rural areas. There's also some of that just spiteful, you know, I'll show you. The other thing was that the price of that was right in a time when the price of gas was going up, and so the price of fertilizer was going up. And it was, you know, do you really need that fertilizer? Do you really need all that stuff? And you know, I'd gone home when I was a student to help plant soybeans, and you know, we used the pre-emergent herbicide Treflan. And then after I'd gotten into medical school and so on and so forth, I still was occasionally there, but I said, boys, I'll help out, but I'm not spraying the Treflan. You can do it if you think it's necessary, but I'm not doing it. And that was a major break in the family because they just, I was in medical school and I'm not willing to do this. and it really threatened the way they saw doing things. Both my younger brothers went to ag school. I didn't, obviously.
Why did you want to spray that
tournament? Is it good for you? You know, they talk about all these things you got to be careful about and so on and so forth. And, you know, the data needed to be, this won't cause trouble. It's not a matter of it hasn't caused trouble. You got to prove to me it won't cause trouble. And that's not the way the data was set up. And in fact, when you really began to look at the data, two-thirds of stuff in the market didn't even have enough data for what's called a health hazard assessment, which was the minimal research needed to be done to let a product on the market. Two-thirds of it, not even a health hazard assessment. So that sort of kicked things up a ways. And then, where are we?
So you weren't spraying the triflam, then what was going to happen?
Well, in my mind, the triflam was a pre-emergent herbicide. It was to keep the weeds out, yeah. What else could be done? As far as they were concerned, there wasn't any alternative. This way you got to do it.
What were you thinking?
I'm thinking there's got to be other ways of doing it. I don't know what those are, but it's about time to find out. And it's also time to find out just exactly where the data is concerning herbicides and pesticides, because I didn't know at that point. One of the things we did find, and I'm jumping ahead, but to give an example, the U.S. Geological Survey has been looking at a field up here in Guilford County. It's an old tobacco field, and they've been in there now probably 20 years, and they're looking at both surface water and groundwater as to whether or not there are chemicals in there, and if so, what is it? They continue to find, in both the surface water and the groundwater, chemicals not only that's being used now, but they know have not been used in the last 20 years that are still in the ground. So even if we change what is being used, the old stuff, you know, is it still there? Well, shouldn't we find out? Now, it's the old business. If I put a salt shaker on the table and tell you that, you know, triflam's in there, let's shake a little bit on your soybeans before you eat them today, you'd say, wait a minute. But if I serve them to you with no sign on that says this has triflam, it wouldn't wipe down, you know, and probably walk out and feel it is fine. I don't expect you to keel over, but, at some point, there may be a problem with that. And I don't think that people basically want to take that risk. And that's what we're seeing now. You talk about people's changing, you know, how they're eating and who they're buying it from, so on and so forth. They're buying it from people that they can go out and look at the farm, or it's been certified, or, you know, that they know personally, and they know how that crop's grown. And on the farmer's side, you don't feed something to somebody that's your friend. And there's a whole new ethic that's evolving here about agriculture. And, you know, then the question becomes, if we look at my old thing about, you know, can the rural areas make money? It's taken a lot longer than I thought it was going to take. And we haven't necessarily converted everybody, that's for sure. But it ain't where it used to be. And those are markets up there and all over the place that are rocking and rolling. And the problem is production. There isn't enough production. Which makes it a very different situation than where we were 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So that project did set up markets in Tennessee, and then I came over here on a fellowship in 78, and the fellowship was boring. Oh my goodness. It's supposed to look at health, how to change healthcare systems, but it was just it was too much pushing me to be willing to sit there and listen for very long. So we ended up setting up the agriculture marketing project here and the Student Health Coalition here in that year, and the first market we set up was the one that is now in Carrboro, and it's considered one of the best in the country. There are 90 people in it. You got to be within 50 miles of the market. They're not there because they're just sort of, you know, it's pocket money. They're there because they're serious about it, and they're new trucks, and they're this, that, and the other thing. That doesn't mean they're making a great living, but they're sure doing a whole lot better than anybody ever thought they would.
And I want to talk about the startup of the farmers market in our next conversation.
Okay.
Right. Get a feel of how the fits and starts of that.
Right. We've gotten off track here.
No, we're good.
Okay.
We're good. The question I had down here was, who was your mentor or teacher or inspiration in the early days? And you mentioned some of these people from the medical community. Were there people in the farm community who were inspirations?
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Christie was certainly one of them, Reese Rillo, J.W. Bradley, who's up in East Tennessee and was the leader behind the Anastrip Mining Group, and is just got more guts than anybody I've ever known. There were people in the agriculture community, Herschel Ligon. He was the guy with the NFO, and Herschel. Herschel Ligon, that's not the one I was thinking about. Herschel Ligon and Matt Caldwell and Hugh Thompson was another one. Hugh had Dairy Farm and there had been a milk strike in Nashville. In fact, when I first went there was a milk strike going on, and they shut them down. I mean, they stopped milk. And, well, it was about price and what they were willing to pay the farmer and what they were selling it for.
So the farmers refused to sell the milk.
Right.
Because the price was
too high. And it was handled by the National Farmers Organization, the NFO. And unfortunately, the NFO's leadership wasn't as tough as some of the membership was. And so it worked, but it didn't do what it could have done. And there were a lot of hard feelings about that. Herschel was more into hogs. The other guy who was one of my heroes in some respects and a great guy was Nat Caldwell, who was a reporter for the Nashville Tennessean. And Nat had gotten a Pulitzer back in the 50s, I guess. He's the guy who put the finger on John L. Lewis for his being on both sides of the coal issue. He had been an owner and a union leader. But Matt knew more about TVA in the South and stuff, and he was a great old guy, and always had his soup spill on his tie and crumbs, and he looked disheveled and was, and so on and so forth. But by God, he was a bulldog. You know, he would get into stuff, and I guess the big contribution he made to us was that when we had done a couple of years worth of these health fairs and worked in these communities and facilities could be set up, if we could find the money for it, if we being the communities. I was out at Matt's one night, and he and I were sitting around talking, and there were two things about that night. I've never met his son, but there was a portrait of his son in sort of an impressionistic painting up over the mantle. And the kid looked like me, and it really rocked me some. But beyond that, I said, Matt, where are these communities, these old coal communities, going to find the money to put up health facilities? And he said, well, I'll tell you where the money is. He said, what's going on up there is that the land that's there that's got coal under it is not being assessed for that coal. State law says that you got to assess what's on the surface and what's underneath for obvious reasons. But what you find when you get up there in those records, you'll find that the tax office is only charging for what's on the surface. And so the wealth of those counties, and there are five coal mining counties in Tennessee, probably there are a few more, but those are the five major ones, are losing who knows how much money. And I said, can we organize around that? And he said, that's your problem. He said, you do the organizing. I'll just tell you where the money is. So come back to John Devina, who I had spoken about before, and Alan Orman and Bob Thompson were three students who we hired for the summer. And a guy named Les Dunbar, who ran the Field Foundation at that time, sprang for the money. He didn't necessarily know it, I don't think, at the time, but he did. We always had sort of a little kitty on the side called Special Projects that we could wheel out for things like this. So the three of them, to get back to it, spent the summer up in those courthouses up in East Tennessee, at some risk to themselves, going through the tax books, find out, you know, what's the coal company X paying for the land that's adjacent to farmer Y, and it was clearly the farmer and the coal company were paying the same per acre. And when they asked about that, they said, well, we don't know where that coal is. Well, now, wait a minute. You know, I mean, obviously somebody bought this piece of land because they know where the coal is, and that's the reason they bought it. They didn't go over here and ask Mr. X about his place because they knew there wasn't anything under there. There are coal maps. Oh, no. Well, to make a long story short, yes, they were. You know, they knew where that coal was. And the potential revenue for that could do a whole lot for those counties who were starving. I mean, they were the bad roads and the bad schools and the bad social services and there's no medical care. And that, you know, the wealth was there. It was being trucked out, though. Now, there were nine major landowners, coal company landowners, in those five counties. Seven of the nine were locally coal companies, big, but and two of them were from out of state. The American Association, which was owned by the guy who actually was the mayor of London at the time, and I've forgotten the name of the other company right now. Sorry. But there were two major in-state landowners of coal lands, Senator Howard Baker and Senator Albert Gore, senior. He later on became the president of Island Creek Coal Company, and Howard Baker had his heart set on running for the presidency. So all of a sudden, this little project we're dinking around out there, all of a sudden, whoa, what's going on here? And that's when things really got, you know, I mean, it's sort of like being down there in Williamson County. We're just dealing with these little kids with toothbrushes, you know, and they're, what the hell is the problem? And now we're up there, you know, we're just dinking around trying to get some folks some health care. What's the problem? Well, the problem's big. And
that's almost the definition of an outside agitator.
Yeah.
You get in and you discover the sad truth.
Yeah. Well, it's not, It always is going to be different. It's going to be different than what you think it's going to be, that's for sure. But that whole situation is certainly not any different now. And now they allow mountaintop removal. I mean, they're going wide open. What was done on the citizen side was because I'd worked in a lot of those communities and knew and had the confidence of some people in those communities. I could sort of, you know, with time, look to see who was going to be willing to stick their neck out on the strip mine issue, because it was not without dangers and of a lot of different sorts. So when when the summer was over with and we had the data about, you know, the coal and the coal companies and the non-payment taxes, we went to see John Siegenthaler down at who was then the editor of at the National Tennessean, about, you know, what to do with it. And he had a friend who was a judge and a lawyer at that time, who's now a judge, whose name I'm not able to call up, took the case, and a citizens group from East Tennessee of people that we had talked to about, you know, were they willing to file suit against the state for not enforcing the tax laws at a great deal of risk to themselves. And a number of them were willing to step forward. J.W. Bradley was the head of that organization and is no longer the head of it, but still very active and not one to dally around and doesn't have the patience to deal with sometimes things that have to be done first. Gradually, the economics have changed somewhat. The performance of the federal government in relation to coal mining has not changed. And I think with the present energy situation looking at us, they're going to be going wide open just like they were before. And it is a travesty beyond imagination to go up there and see what's being done. I mean, they allow them to take, I mean, literally take the top of the mountain off and you know, down the sides. That does some of your health also, your mental health. And I mean, there are always dams breaking and people being killed and so on and so forth. You know, but that's back to God, legally. But what happens to you when you, the only place you can get a job is in those mines, or you know, the place you've been able to see all your life and for the family's life is suddenly gone. So at any rate, that gets us where? That gets us...
to Part 12.
Okay.
And, I mean, it kind of gets us to the question of this piece of land. And the kind of how you started things up, was it, you know, easy, complicated?
Yeah.
What was going on when you finally did settle on Bayshore Farm?
Yeah. One of the problems, let me just, a little addendum here. One of the problems of doing something like this is that it happened because there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people involved, some good and some bad and some in between. And you don't want to leave people out, and that's the part that always worries me. I mean, people ought to be recognized for what they did. Okay. I just
think
he's like, yeah. It's like, and two people. One of them you may know, Les Dunbar. You may know Les was head of Field Foundation, but he lived in Durham for a long time, and has written about Appalachia and so on. He had a book signing two or three years ago at the Regulator, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. And I just a quick story to show you the fact that it is people that make the difference. When we hashed up this idea about putting together these farmers markets, we've been doing a student health coalition for a while, and people knew that worked. But this was a new idea, and we just sort of, you know, and Les with the Field Foundation was one of those foundations that helped people initiate things. There are maintenance people and there are initiators, and the initiators are few and far between, and they are valuable. And Les was the right guy for it. And the Field Foundation has helped us get started, and then, you know, gone on to get money from other places, Johnson and other places. But anyway, when we got this idea about the markets, I called him, and he said, well, I'm going to be down that way. Well, I'll meet somewhere, which we did at this restaurant about halfway between Nashville and up in the mountains. And it was at a round table with a lady Susan in the middle. I remember that. And so we told him what we want to do. We just farmers markets. And he looked at me and he said, "You really think it's going to work?" I said, "Yeah, it's going to work." All right, let's do it. That was it. And the idea was good, but the other thing was that we had done what we said we were going to do for the year before, you know. But here's a guy willing, I mean, he doesn't know what's going to work. I don't know what's going to work. But he said, "All right, let's do it." And we got, you know, I mean, literally, I can say that there's a straight line from what he said that day to that Carver's Farmer Market up there. A very straight line. And people like Les and others need to get the credit for sticking their neck out.
So what did he do after he said yes?
They put up the money.
To
start organizing markets. I mean, it was started in Tennessee. Lindsey Jones and John Volchek ran the thing to begin with. Laurie Heise, whom you may know, who lives over here and sells the market there in Carborough, was one of the organizers for him. Came over here. Well, let's say that. But at any rate, it funded the project that organized the markets. So
you're telling me all this about organizing, and I'm getting this thread of organizing work, but here you are, you're not just organizing, you are farming yourself.
Right, right.
Which I guess goes back to that thread of having grown up on the farm.
I mean, we are all, most of us, I shouldn't say all, most of us are genetically equipped to do farming. I mean, it's the reason we survived. And if we couldn't do it, we wouldn't be here today. So genetically, we're there. And I think some of us, you like doing it. I mean, you can cuss at it and angst over it and everything else. But, hey. Now,
did you miss when you left Mississippi and left family farm? Did you miss it?
There were things about it that were good. I mean, there were those times of doing things together. You know, I mean, there aren't a lot of things that families can do together. And farm is one of them, one of the few. That doesn't mean we all got along. hardly the case, but probably the most. Probably the thing most influential in my life growing up was the fact that the folks bought 100 acres, I guess it was 100 acres, of old, worn-out cotton land up in Kemper County. I mean worn out. And didn't pay much for it because it wasn't worth much. And had grown up in pine and sweet gum. And this was the mid-60s, early to mid-60s, I guess. And went down and bought some axes and a crosscut saw and said, "Boys, go to it." And, I mean, I'm sure there were many, many times that I thought I'd better be doing anything. But, in fact, I think, and I've talked to my brothers about it, I think, in retrospect, that was probably the most important thing that happened to us when we were kids. Now, my youngest brother was around when the farm was was operable. It wasn't a matter of cutting trees and clearing land. It was, and there wasn't any bulldozers and there wasn't any cart chainsaw either, by the way. My mother was scared to death of equipment, and we were not going to have a chainsaw, and hence the crosscut saw. Which is sort of one of those things that you can sort of beat yourself about, but it makes a good story. But at any rate, where were we? When my youngest brother came along, we were producing hay and so on and so forth. And so for his peers, they had a state championship football team. They were good, but John managed the hoodoo, most of those guys into coming up and working at the farm, putting up hay and stuff. And anytime you get any of them around, even today, I mean, these are grown guys that, you know, are doing this, that, and the other things. The first thing they start talking about is the farm. And it wasn't theirs, but you would think from the way they talk about it, it belongs to them. And so a farm is more than just, I mean, it, you know, you hope you make a living out of it, but there's something else there too. So, anyhow, my mother was a great gardener. You know, vegetables and stuff was not the challenge for her. What she was trying to do is to figure out how to get native wildflowers to grow in environments that they weren't native to. And she was the. And I think she also, in her mind somewhere, was concerned about the chemical issue. Was too much invested in what was going on there to make any real commotion about it. But I think she was worried about it too.
Well, Elliot Coleman, I was reading in his book, he was talking about that you can have inputs from nature. Create your own inputs, or you can get stuck in the inputs that are brought to you by the salesman. And that the salesman is very persuasive.
Very persuasive, yeah. They rule agriculture in many respects, the chemical guys. I mean, that, you know, I mean, just look at the names, Attack, I mean, Bravo. I mean, you haven't got to figure out, I mean, who was the guy that was the comedian that was from over in Yazoo City who'd been a chemical dealer, I can't remember his name. At any rate, Jerry Clower. I mean, and that, you know, the jokes and the humor and stuff that runs through all that, the detail guys, if you want to call them, I mean, medicine's got them, they call detail people. Agriculture's got them, they call the chemical people. They're running all of us. You know, I mean, I could be very expressive about that, but I'll refrain. But they've got, they run the show. They're slick. They got big money behind them, and they show that it works. Now nobody wants to dig into it too far because maybe it isn't what we think it is. But soybean got to look good. Yeah, there's no weed in them either. Hey. But do I want to eat them? Now, that gets a little bit different. And I guess that was one of the things. My mother always balked at using chemicals in the garden. That's not that it didn't happen, but it was on the side of, let's be careful here. So
when did you first set eyes on this piece of land?
Well, I've been over here on that fellowship in 78, and when that year was up, the Student Health Coalition and the Agriculture Marketing Project in Alabama was just at a point of development that they were looking at what could they put together in terms of an organization to sort of be an umbrella organization for all that stuff going on. What we'd done at Vanderbilt was create the Center for Health Services. So the folks in Alabama asked me to come down there and work with them to see about putting together that umbrella piece. And I had an appointment and was paid out of the family practice department. So at the end of that year, one of the reasons for going down there that agreed to it was my father had been, we've all got the heart disease. And he'd had several major heart attacks and was in congestive heart failure, still getting around, but not in good health, and, you know, we were sort of winding down, it was clear. And he, as I said before, he and I hadn't always gotten along very well, and I just decided it was, you know, if things were going to get straightened out at all, I need to be down there, not somewhere else. So I spent a lot of time over in Mississippi with him and working with the folks there at University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa for a year. And then Dad died in March, as I recall, and it took a long time to go through boxes and boxes, and I mean, just it took, and I couldn't get, I was going to leave, and so the time was on my back to get it done, and my brothers, who weren't going to be leaving, they, you're doing fine, just, you know. So, I've been seeing the woman who I had dated back in times past, who had become a midwife and was a nurse practitioner and was on the faculty at this point up in Rochester with a very fine program up there. But she was ready to leave Rochester, and I was not planning on staying in Mississippi. So I said, wherever, you know, if you can find a job as a midwife, which is what she wanted to do, wherever, I'll go there because I can take with me, you know, whatever. And I made a mistake, and I call it that because in some respects it was. I was telling her there was a birth center in Sauk City at that point. And I told her that. I said, you know, you really ought to get in touch with those folks down there. And once the cat was out of the bag, why, you know, and I really didn't particularly, I wanted to go back to Tennessee, what I wanted to do. I didn't particularly want to come back over here. But I also knew you can't go back home. And so the Tennessee thing was up in the air. And the folks here offered a job. So got together with a woman who was selling real estate, still is, Elizabeth Anderson. And she knew about this place for rent. And came to look at it. Done. And
so you started renting it or you bought it?
We rented it for a couple of years. And then she and I realized that we just couldn't live in the same house together. She's a very important person to me. But it just wasn't to be. And so I stayed, and she left. She's out in Albuquerque now. If you pick up a midwife journal, you'll find her name there somewhere. She's made a tremendous contribution, and great lady. Anyway, ended up marrying a guy here whose folks were from Albuquerque, and so that was one of the reasons for going out there. He wanted to go back home. So I bought this place, and
what about it? Did you strip down the soil or the solar?
What I did was it had grown up not as bad as the stuff in Mississippi, but it had grown up. There were sweet gums and pines, and you know, so spent some time really cleaning it up. The place where number four is now, out there in front of the shed, was the flattest place out there. So I tilled that and planted a garden in there, and it did well. Oh boy, you know. And my dealings with the Agriculture Extension Service here were, and the extension agent who's there now, Debbie Luce, who's very good, always dislikes my saying this, but it's just the truth. We'd always had an extension agent down home, Bobby Ross, who was a chemical guy, but in those days everybody was chemical. But there was a good relationship between he and the folks and so on and so forth, and somebody they really looked to. When I went to see people over here, they sent me around to see this guy, I had taken on the idea about organic agriculture partly because of what I'd seen going on within the farmers' markets and, you know, the uncertainty about the chemicals. So I went to see the guy over here in Extension Service thinking that, you know, Bobby Ross existed everywhere and we'd sit down and talk. I told this guy what I wanted to do, and he said, well, I said, you down south now, boy, and you can't, I don't think that kind of stuff worked down here. And I said, no, you misunderstand. I said, I'm up north. I'm from down Mississippi, and I'm up north, and I think we can do that up here. And that was about as far as we ever went. And the guy who, he was the guy they directed me to, so I went to the head of the department over there and had a pretty good, I guess his second year, started growing broccoli and some other stuff that I had tried when I was over in Nashville. I'd really started gardening when I was over in Nashville for a couple of years, just this idea of can you get the supermarkets and folks to buy from you, just my own little experiment. And I sold most of the crop to a guy that had that was a produce guy in a supermarket, the name of which I've forgotten now. But what I do remember about that was I came in one day and I'd grown central head broccoli, which is a big central head on it, you know, and it's nice looking stuff. And premium crop was the name of the variety. And he'd buy everything I had, and at a good price. And I, you know, so he was helping me, and I was helping him, and I learned something about the produce side of things. And I got in there one day, and he laughed. He said, I haven't got a complaint about your broccoli this week. I said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, the federal woman came in here, and she said, you know, you've been cheating me on this broccoli. He said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, look here. In this one here, there's only one stem. And you know, I usually get four stems. And you think, oh my God. Yeah, but are you buying it for the stem or the head? You know, and so here's a woman who's the happy housewife, in all due respects, who hasn't got a clue as to, you know, where's the value of that buy. Now, that's not to say that the stem doesn't have got some value to it, but most folks are not after the stem. But they're just counting stems. That's all they're doing. And you're providing them with glorious broccoli, and they ain't got a clue. Well, so the educational problem on the consumer side is also it's not to be left out. And the other story that came up about that, was, and this tells you how times have changed. The first time we ever had a market there in Nashville, the woman who was the secretary for the dean of the medical school, John Chapman, had a daughter who was in high school and wanted to be a forest ranger. And this is, that's pretty dodgy at that time, especially for a female. So they're going to go to the farmer's market and check it out. And I was really interested to see what they're, because, you know, she was a woman that I'm sure influenced other folks, but was fairly, you know, was fairly typical Tennessee, bright, but probably a couple generations off the farm. And so I went in to see, and I said, well, what did you think? She said, well, she said, you know, it was great, but my daughter was a little upset about it. I said, well, what happened? She said, well, she said, you know, we got down to the end of the line, and she took me aside. She said, Mama, you're not going to buy food from the dirty old farmers, are you? You know, so it just, you know, little things like that, some of which you remember and some of which don't, are the things that sort of boot you into realizing sort of where you need to be going. And, it, you know, you're not reading out of a textbook or somebody's formula or somebody's strategy or somebody. It's a matter of listening to what people are saying and realizing, whoops, well, you got to do something about that. So that's the kind of stuff we got to where we are, I guess. I don't know that.
So would you have to, does that mean you have to put on a suit when you go to deliver the food, or that you get to wash some of the dirt off of it, or what?
Well, I think those dirty old farmers probably don't look quite as dirty as we're old, I think, at this point, but I don't think it had to do with the food. I think it had to do with the farmers and how, you know, they had on big overalls and brogans and, you know, probably had been in the cow shed before they got in the truck. But And those aren't the people that are farming anymore. They're dead and gone in many respects, unfortunately. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And we owe a lot to the ones that, you know, we're there and we're willing to make a change. I guess that's a good time.
Yeah. Okay, right.
How much more you want to do?